From WBUR Boston, I'm Gail Harris, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. On his first trip to Europe since his re-election, President Bush has been all smiles and handshakes. Last night, he dined with French President Jacques Chirac. This morning, he ate breakfast with Prime Minister Tony Blair before beginning his whirlwind tour of Brussels, meeting with NATO and EU leaders, bearing a message of reconciliation and unity. Last night, in his keynote speech, the president said that no temporary debate, no passing disagreement of governments, no power on earth will ever divide Europe and the U.S. Tonight on Point, President Bush's trip to Europe, what it means for Europe, the U.S., and the transatlantic partnership. We begin in Brussels, where, after his meeting with EU leaders, President Bush spoke about U.S. reservations if Europe chooses to lift its arms embargo on China.
There is deep concern in our country that a transfer of weapons would be a transfer of technology to China, which would change the balance of relations between China and Taiwan.
In spite of these differences, the president has committed himself to what he has called a listening tour. Daniel Dombey is EU diplomatic correspondent for the Financial Times. I ask him what the president should be listening for in his meetings with European leaders this week.
It's interesting that he says that he's on a listening tour. I remember actually that Tom Friedman, the New York Times columnist, said that the president should say that he's all ears, because after the signals that the U.S. gave off, particularly during the time of the Iraq War, people got the sense that the U.S. just wasn't interested in other people's points of view. And that, I think, was at the heart of their characterization of the U.S. as a kind of unilateralist power. People want to make sure that he listens to Europe's concerns on those issues where Europe is different. Now, top on those lists are issues like climate change, where Europe has embraced the Kyoto Protocol, which it understands the U.S. doesn't like, but is interested to see what the U.S. will do as a kind of comparable measure. And it's also to do with issues such as Iran, where the Europeans are negotiating with the Tehran regime, and where the U.S. really actively become involved, and the Chinese arms embargo, which the EU placed in 1989 on Beijing after the Tiananmen Square massacre, and which now plans to remove, much to Washington's concern.
And of all of those concerns, Daniel, the Middle East, Iraq, Syria, Iran, where do you think the U.S. can expect the EU to make the most significant contributions?
Well, it's interesting, actually. I mean, people say this is a kind of Marshall McLuhan kind of trip. I mean, it's not so much the medium is the message, but the meeting is the message. And I think that's a nice way of saying, really, that we haven't seen any substantive changes in position so far this week, and we haven't really seen any major concessions by either side. In its NATO incarnation, that is when Mr. Bush met with the NATO leaders today, they offered a little bit of help in Iraq, 160-person training mission in Baghdad, but that's really not going to change the situation of that country around. The Europeans haven't, by contrast, got the response from the U.S. they wanted on Iran. They haven't really got the response they wanted on climate change. But the language is a bit more of dialogue. And I think the understanding from both sides is that if they can keep talking to each other, they can defuse disputes and try and work towards solutions. And we've seen a bit of that. France and the U.S. reinforce their partnership over the issue of Syria and Lebanon.
You mentioned a moment ago NATO's new announcement about a modest plan to train and equip some of these army and police officers in Iraq. Sounds like progress, although it doesn't really take the burden off American troops there. But is it important as a bit of symbolism?
Well, it is, but up to a point, as an English novelist once wrote. Just remember, the NATO mission in Baghdad costs rather less than 20 million euros, which is less than $30 million. The financing that they secured today was 4 million euros. Well, I'm pretty sure the Bush trip cost a multiple of 4 or 20 million euros. So the money is really tiny compared to the day-to-day business of international diplomacy. The commitment is wide across NATO. All 26 countries are contributing. But if you look at it, you realize that it might be wide, but it's not terribly deep. France is contributing by an offer to train gendarmes who are halfway between police and army in Qatar, an offer that hasn't been taken up, and by releasing one person, one French national, to help coordinate equipment transfers to the Iraqi army, safe from his base in Belgium.
In addition to the dignitaries and the diplomats, how is this visit being received by the European public? If this is a kiss and make-up tour, do the Europeans seem willing to be kissed?
That's a good question. I think the Europeans are being a little bit chaste this time round. And I don't think anyone very much in European public opinion feels passionately keen on Mr. Bush. But it's quite hard to kind of protest very strongly against him when he's come with this message of reconciliation. So I think I would say there's a guarded response. And remember, this is a continent where you saw millions march when the Iraq War began. 3 million in Spain alone by one count. And US diplomats, I think, acknowledge that the only way they can really get back to where they want to be is by engaging European governments and by gradually winning over public opinion, if possible, after that.
Daniel, later this week, there will be a meeting between President Bush and Russia's President Putin, who certainly can't be very happy with the public wrist-slapping he got from Bush on Monday. What's the speculation there about what might come from that meeting?
I think there's no doubt at all that from a policy point of view, rather than from a choreography point of view, the single most interesting thing out of this trip has been what Mr. Bush has been saying about Russia, consistently scolding Russia and reminding it of the importance of democracy, the rule of law and a free press. He really has missed no opportunity to say that. When he meets Mr. Putin in Bratislava on Thursday, I think that's clearly going to be the most interesting encounter of his whole trip because it can't be scripted. These people are coming from different angles. Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov had some fairly sharp comments to make today about the US criticism, and it's not going to be the same kind of reconciliation show that we've seen in Europe.
Daniel, overall, how would you characterize the post-Iraq war partnership that might emerge between the US and the European Union?
Pragmatic. I think it's pragmatic. People realize that President Bush is not only the President of the United States, he's a very powerful President of the United States with the United Congress behind him. They also realize that there is no point having a kind of second-grade Cold War across the Atlantic. There is, however, still a fundamental difference, I think, between the readiness of some Europeans to use engagement, that is, negotiations, to deal with problems of challenging states, and the response of the US that feels that at a certain point the time for talk has gone and the time for action has arrived. So people are trying to work through their problems. They're trying to find solutions where they can, minimize problems where they can't. It's a pragmatic cooperation, but it's not a meeting of minds.
Daniel Dombey, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Daniel Dombey is EU diplomatic correspondent for the Financial Times. He spoke with us from Brussels, Belgium. We're talking this hour about President Bush's charm offensive in Europe this week, and we invite you to join the conversation. What do you see as the president's mission? Is it time for the United States and Europe to make up? And what will it take for their differences to be overcome? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now from Stanford, California, is Dennis Bark, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution and a historian and political scientist in European studies. His forthcoming book is Dancing in the Dark, Conversations on Europe and America. Dennis, welcome.
Thank you very much.
So what do you make of what you've seen so far? Is there reason for hope now after 2+ years of acrimony?
I think there's enormous reason for hope, and I think the stage was set about 10 days ago when the Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, made her first visit as Secretary to Europe. She delivered a major speech in Paris before students, business leaders, and political leaders, and it was very well received. And she did so, and European there commented on this, with a great deal of style combined with substance, making the point that Europeans need America just as we need Europe, namely, let's share responsibility, not rivalry. In politics, symbols and style are important, and I think she was aware of that, and certainly the Europeans have been aware of that for a long time. The visit of President Bush to Europe is full of both style and symbols. The president's trip is the first one of his second term. Secretary of State Rice's trip was the first for her as well. The first leader that Bush met day before yesterday and had him for dinner was the president of France. And it was interesting that Jacques Chirac said at an impromptu press conference before dinner that he valued the excellent relations that have existed for over 200 years between France and America. And he did that on purpose. And he also said on purpose that these relations are based on common values that we both share and that things don't change overnight merely because someone waves a wand. That is superficial on the one hand, but I think it's of enormous symbolic importance on the other. The mood in Brussels yesterday was described by the Prime Minister of Belgium as one of open, and it was open and positive, and it was very clear that President Bush and his the members of his group were willing to listen. I mean, those are the Prime Minister of Belgium's words, not mine. And at the end of this little interview with the Prime Minister of Belgium, he said, in short, it was not business as usual. That gives good reason to hope, and I think that the best reason for hope is what the president said in his speech yesterday. At the beginning of it, he called the alliance the main pillar of our security. I mean, those are not hollow words. He spoke about joint responsibilities in the world and about the importance of renewing the American-European alliance of freedom. And finally, in talking about this commitment, it was no accident that he said, quote, freedom is a long-distance race. And that's a quote that comes from a very famous French novelist, Albert Camus. That was no accident either. So
something of a surprise, but no accident. Dennis, hold the thought. We're going to have to take a break, and then we'll be back in just a moment. We're talking this hour about Bush's European tour. Are his meetings today with NATO and the EU positive signs for a stronger transatlantic partnership? How much does Europe still matter? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about transatlantic partnerships between the U.S. and the EU. Today, after his meeting with NATO leaders, President Bush acknowledged their commitment to train and equip Iraq's new army and police force.
NATO is doing a vital mission, which is to help an officer corps emerge. The truth of the matter is, in order for Iraq to be a secure country, there has to be a chain of command that is effective and works.
And so we ask you, is this NATO commitment symbolic of the greater role that Europe can play, both diplomatically and militarily? And after so much opposition to the war in Iraq, is this a sign that the U.S. and Europe can move forward together? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're talking with Dennis Bark, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, a historian and political scientist in European studies. And joining me now from Washington is Charles Kupchan, professor of international relations at Georgetown University. He was director of European affairs on the National Security Council during the first Clinton administration and is also the author of The End of the American Era, U.S. Foreign Policy and the Geopolitics of the 21st Century. Welcome to you, Charles.
Thank you. Glad to join you.
Well, we heard cause for optimism from Dennis a moment ago. What do you see?
I more or less agree with Dennis that this is a historic trip that holds the potential to make progress in repairing the relationship. I would be somewhat more guarded in my pronouncement that we're there. I think we've taken the first baby step. I wouldn't have guessed 4 months ago that if Bush were reelected, he would be heading to Europe with flowers in hand to talk about the importance of the Atlantic Alliance. And the reason I'm withholding judgment is I haven't seen enough beef yet. The one area where there has been concrete progress is in the Middle East peace process, where the two sides are coming together now that there is momentum. But on many other issues, I fear that we're still miles apart from the Europeans, especially on climate change, on the International Criminal Court, on Iran, on the arms embargo, on China. And even today, for example, there was generally a very good atmosphere, and Bush talked about the importance of NATO. But at the same time, Chirac, the president of France, said he supported Schroeder's comments in Munich about 10 days ago that NATO is losing in its centrality and that now the EU is where the action is at. So even on a day when it was all warm and fuzzy, there's now yet a new issue that's before the leaders.
Well, and even with all of these knotty problems that still face them, you know, granting that the president is stronger on rhetoric right now than on content, but you have to start somewhere. Isn't that the place to start?
Yes, and I give Bush an enormous amount of credit for the change in tone. If you look carefully at his speech yesterday in Brussels, it contrasts dramatically with the speeches of the last 4 years, or certainly 3 years. Terrorism came in only at the end. He talked about the need not just to get the bad guys, but to deal with the sources of alienation. That's very much what the Europeans like to hear. And he hit on a bunch of different issues that will be music to the ears of Europeans, the need for a stronger EU and European unity. That certainly will be greeted with glee after several years of talk from Don Rumsfeld about splitting old Europe from new Europe. So at the level of body language, at the level of rhetoric, I would give Bush an A. In terms of follow-through and completing the mission, I would give him an incomplete. Let's see what happens.
Well, and Charles Kupchan, is it inevitable that this relationship would have to change over time? I mean, you think about what has changed over the decades. Germany's no longer a threat. There are no Soviet tanks on the borders of Eastern Europe. So is this a relationship that perhaps doesn't need to be as close as it once did?
I think there's no question that the answer is yes, and that a lot of people feel that this is a rift that is the result of personality. Bush on the one side, Chirac and Schroeder on the other. I think this is primarily about deeper structural change, the end of the Cold War, the gradual maturation of Europe as a union, 9-1-1 and its differential impact on threat perception. That doesn't mean that the hard-edged policies of Bush didn't fuel it, but I do think that we are talking about a world that just looks different. And if you say to the Europeans, is NATO still the apple of your eye? The answer is no, because Europe is generally at peace. If you say the same thing to Americans, the answer is also no, because we're now focused like a laser beam on the Middle East. And frankly, sending 160 trainers to Iraq isn't a big deal, other than in symbolic terms. So the world is changing, and that's part of the reason we're having so much trouble putting Humpty Dumpty back together again.
Hmm. And Dennis Bark, I want to hear from you on that point as well. Do you see this as a relationship that it's okay if there's more distance there now than there used to be?
Oh, I agree. I mean, the world is changing. And in a way, you could express it by saying that both Europeans and Americans are in the woodshed of success. The reason we have these problems is because we successfully ended the Cold War without a shot. We preserved freedom on Europe, and now we have to figure out where we want to go and how we're going to get there. And we've had a real tough time doing that, not only during the last 4 years, but during the 1990s as well. There's a value in combining symbolism with style and substance, and that value is, and Charles mentioned this and you did too, is that you've got to begin somewhere. And here, I think, where you begin is by listening and talking. Everyone knows and can recite by heart the litany of all of the problems that divide us. One of those, which unfortunately is not cited often enough, is that we've been talking about the problems and not about the things that we have in common.
Well, what about that? I'm curious to hear what you see as the shared interest, because that's a good point.
We have a shared interest in protecting freedom. We have a shared interest in democratic government. We have a shared interest in free markets. We have a shared interest in peace and prosperity. We want to be in a position to preserve and defend both. Those are not just idle words. I mean, those things are what makes the free world go around. And we need to talk a little bit more about it, I think.
And Dennis Bark, do you see that as something we should be talking about more as well, rather than thinking about the things that divide us? Should we be speaking more about the war on terror, instability in the Middle East, nuclear proliferation, all the things that Europe and the United States have in common?
I think both Europeans and Americans should. And I think there's one other thing here, too, and that is that it's easy to talk about Europe and America as though the Europeans are one block. That's not true. They got a few problems of their own. For one thing, they were divided about Iraq, and they still are. They have to figure out where they can come back together again, what they can agree on, how they're trying to build a nation. They call it the European Union. They have a long way to go in developing their own free markets, in developing a single market, in using their single currency. They need some moral support from us, which is one reason why the president's welcome of the progress the Europeans are making in the European Union is important. They haven't heard that before.
Charles Kupchan, what about this notion, though, that perhaps it's not in the United States' best interest to have a united Europe with all the clout that that implies? I mean, a strong Europe means 458 million people. A strong euro, maybe that's not such a good idea.
I think this is an issue on which reasonable people disagree. And for the last 55, 60 years, the United States stood behind European unity under the assumption that a strong and stable Europe would ultimately be in America's interests. That consensus cracked in the lead-up and aftermath of the war over Iraq. And I now hear, and here in Washington, and this is not just from Republicans or members of the Bush administration, but right across the political spectrum, do we want a Europe that has a single voice on security policy? What if there were another Iraq or in Iran and looming on the horizon, and we couldn't peel away Britain, Italy, Poland? Do we really want that? And I think that's a very valid point. My own view is that ultimately a stronger Europe will be a better partner, not a challenger to the United States. And that's because, in part, as Dennis said, ultimately we do want the same thing. And also, I think part of the problem in the last few years has stemmed from Europe's weakness. They haven't been able to carry the water because they don't have the capability. An EU that has a single foreign minister, that has a diplomatic corps, that has more military capability, I think will be a better partner and less resentful of the United States, less anti-American in attitude.
I'm reminded of the quote from Henry Kissinger, who once said that he'd start paying attention to Europe once Europe had a phone number that he could call. So you have to wonder, does the EU have that number now and it rings in Brussels?
Well, there is a so-called security policy czar. And in the new constitution, which is now up for ratification, the first country, Spain, voted on the referendum over the weekend, voted yes, by the way. This new constitution will appoint a single foreign minister. It will give Europe more of a unitary character, something along the lines of perhaps what the U.S. looked like in the late 19th century. That doesn't mean the EU is headed toward the United States of Europe, but it does mean that it is beginning to have a collective identity and a collective weight that the United States has to take seriously. And I think the more readily and the more fully Washington does that, the better off the relationship will become.
And Dennis Bark, there's another issue that's sort of flying under the radar here, and that is the amount that Europeans spend on defense. Traditionally, they've relied on America to be the strong defender. And is it time now for the EU to start spending more if Europe really wants to be an equal partner with the U.S.?
Well, you said, is it time for the EU to spend more? I mean, we're still at the point where we're looking at how much what the defense budgets are for individual EU countries. By the way, after the United States, the two largest are Great Britain and France, and all the rest of them are 2% or lower. That is a question, whether or not there'll be a EU defense budget and how large it will be and what form it will take is a question for the future. There's something that I want to follow Charles on, and that is the reference to strong Europe. You know, when you choose a friend, you choose a strong one. You don't choose a weak one. And I think the same applies here. I'm not interested in seeing Europe divided and weak. I'm interested in seeing a Europe which is economically strong and politically self-confident and militarily in the position to defend itself as well as other people. That's in the United States' interest. And the European interest, conversely, is exactly the same. The stronger they are, I think the more positively Americans will respond to it, and vice versa. Americans understand competition, whether it's economic or political, and they thrive on it. And they've been doing that for the last 225 years. And with a little healthy competition from people who are our friends and not our enemies, I think we will continue to thrive on it. I think it's a point that's extremely important.
Charles Kupchan, I know you have to go catch a plane in just a second here. Let me ask you one more question. That is, whether you see this as a new reality, that the United States really can't go it alone, or even if it can, it shouldn't want to.
I do think that the Bush administration has backtracked, and I don't see it as a sort of revolution in ideology. I see it as a change of course that is almost exclusively a product of pragmatism. We're in trouble in Iraq, and we need help there and everywhere else. And I think the Bush administration was perhaps a little bit naive about the ability of America's military primacy to do everything that America needed to do in the world. And there's no question in my mind that the U.S. and Europe are, in the long run, much better off if they're working together than if they're working separately. The key is to figure out a concrete agenda for common action. Because even though we do have long-term objectives that are the same, we still continue to diverge over how to get there, the means. And I hope that President Bush's trip can go some distance in that respect. And I also, just to put in one final thought, one other challenge that we haven't talked much about but I think is critical is domestic politics. Because on this side of the Atlantic, I fear that we're seeing the unraveling of the bipartisan coalition that was the basis for a moderate and centrist internationalism. On the other side of the Atlantic, we're seeing the passing of the World War II generation, and they were the real Atlanticists. And I fear that even if Bush does the right thing, he is up against an undercurrent of anti-American sentiment, which may constrain how far leaders in Europe can go to meet Bush halfway. So I think an important part of this discussion has to be how elites on both sides of the Atlantic manage very changed domestic circumstances.
Charles Kupchan, we know you have to go. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Good night.
Charles Kupchan is professor of international relations at Georgetown University and the author of The End of the American Era, U.S. Foreign Policy and the Geopolitics of the 21st Century. I'm Gail Harris, and this is On Point. Joining us now is Richard Morningstar, who is also in Stanford, California. He's the former U.S. ambassador to the European Union from June of 1999 to September 2001, also now a lecturer in public policy at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. Richard Morningstar, welcome to you.
Well, thank you, and good evening.
So far, we've heard a case for optimism and tempered pessimism. What's your assessment of this trip and what's likely to come out of it?
Well, I think the trip was very positive, but I think first I would say that we have to recognize that U.S.-European relations are not a zero-sum game. And we have to look at those relations on a spectrum, and the goal should be to move further, as far up the spectrum as we can. And it's, you know, we're not going to agree on every issue, and we don't have to agree on every issue. Having said that, I think the trips both of Secretary Rice and President Bush have been positive for several reasons. One, simply the fact that they went to Europe and recognized that cooperation is important in various areas. It's like Iraq, Afghanistan, the Middle East peace process. And it also has allowed President Bush to portray himself as a reasonable person, not just to European leaders, but also to the European population, which I think is also important because, after all, they're the people who vote for the leaders.
Well, and beyond that, the last time that we saw the European population, they were taking to the streets, millions of them, London, Rome, Spain, elsewhere. You know, things have certainly seemed warmer from the public perspective
right.
This time around.
Right, and but certainly from polling, President Bush has not been popular anywhere in Europe. I think it's also been important that Secretary Rice and President Bush have voiced strong support for European integration and for a common foreign policy that Charles and Dennis were talking about. I think it is important to backtrack from Rumsfeld's old Europe and new Europe, but I also should say that I don't think that we're giving up much by taking that position. If Europe can develop a common foreign policy on a given issue that we have an interest in, obviously that helps protects us and helps share the burden. On the other hand, the new constitution provides that for Europe or the EU to adopt a common foreign policy on any given issue, that you need to have unanimity. And I think it's highly unlikely that an expanded EU would reach a unanimous decision to adopt a common foreign policy that we were very much in disagreement with. And if that were the case, then we need to relook at our policy.
Richard Morningstar, I have to ask you to hold it right there. You'll rejoin us after the break along with Dennis Bark. And stay with us. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Gail Harris, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harris, in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about President Bush's tour of Europe to mend the relationship between the U.S. and the EU. Today, at a joint news conference with EU leaders, President Bush spoke about U.S. policy on Iran.
This notion that the United States is getting ready to attack Iran is simply ridiculous. Having said that, all options are on the table.
And so we ask you, do you see a joining of hands across the transatlantic divide? Is the Bush visit to Europe the signal of a new era of cooperation? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're speaking this hour with Dennis Bark, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, a historian and political scientist in European studies. And also with us from Stanford, California, is Richard Morningstar, former U.S. ambassador to the European Union, now a lecturer in public policy at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. Gentlemen, this is a really interesting comment that you just heard. On the one hand, the idea we're getting ready to attack Iran is ridiculous, but it's an option. It's on the table. I mean, Dennis, what did you think of that?
Well, I mean, how do I respond to that? The obvious answer is, of course, it's an option which is on the table. I think the president is trying to send a message, which is that the United States is well aware that the European Union is making a concerted effort to try to deal with this problem in Iran, and that we are supportive of it. At the same time, that doesn't mean that we foreclose any and all options. I think that's a wise approach, nothing more and nothing less. But concerning Europe, the Europeans are committed to a negotiation process, and that's a process which President Bush supports, and I think it's a process that all reasonable people support. It's much easier to approach things that way than it is to when they get out of hand, which just leads me to one final remark here. In talking about our efforts to cooperate with the Europeans, I think it was Winston Churchill who said a long time ago that the only thing that's worse than fighting with friends is fighting without them. We've been fighting without some of them, and I think it's time to change that.
We want to go to our phone lines now to Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Oli is on the line. Hello, Oli, and welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here. I think everything that's been said so far makes good sense, but my question is this. What is it that we're offering to the Europeans? We have that we know that they care about Kyoto. We know that they care about the ICC. We have frozen many of them out of reconstruction contracts in Iraq, and so these are nice words that the president has uttered, and Condi Rice as well, but there have to be, seems to me, some tangible benefits for the Europeans to follow our path, whether it be on Iraq, whether it be on Iran, or any of the other tremendously large set of issues on the global agenda.
Good point, Oli. Let me put that to Richard Morningstar first.
Well, I think that's right. We do need to show that there are two sides to this process, and that it's in Europe's interest to be working with us. Certainly, what immediately comes to mind is the Middle East peace process, and for the first time in some time, anyway, there appears to be at least a glimmer of hope that progress can be made, and also indications that this administration is committed to that process. I think that's very important to Europe, and hopefully we can work together and make progress in that area. One other point that hasn't been mentioned, and I think that drives the relationship to a considerable extent, and that's our economic relationship. You know, we have probably the largest trade and investment relationship with Europe than with any other part of the world, and vice versa. Our investment relationship is just huge, and that I think puts a break to our relationship getting out of control to some extent. And I think that it's important that the United States and Europe be able to communicate with each other, consult with each other, talk with each other in order to preserve that relationship. With respect to matters like Kyoto and the International Criminal Court, they are important, obviously, to Europe. I don't think it's realistic to think, it's not realistic to believe that this administration is going to just go out and sign on to the Kyoto Protocol or the International Criminal Court, but we can send signals and do things of a substantive nature that would be helpful. We could start working with Europe as to what will take place after the first stage of the Kyoto Protocol in 2012, start looking at the different research that's been being done on both sides of the ocean, and try to come up with ways to work more closely together with respect to the environment. We need to start looking at some kind of compulsory regulations with respect to emissions. On the International Criminal Court, I don't think it's realistic to think we're going to join at this point, but we don't need to be so combative as to fighting the International Criminal Court. Do you realize we're telling various countries that we won't give any military assistance unless they sign an agreement with us bilaterally that would make us immune from any kind of prosecution relating to that country? That's the kind of thing that we should be pulling back from, and at least taking a neutral stance towards the criminal court and letting time take its course and seeing how it works.
To Chuck now, who's on the line from Snow Hill, North Carolina. Hi, Chuck. Welcome.
Good evening. How are y'all doing?
Good, thanks. Go ahead.
I'm hearing a lot of rhetoric about the improvement of the relationship with Europe, and I'm just wondering, as an American taxpayer, how will I benefit by an improved relationship? And I'd like a response addressed from the perspective of two different people. One would be if I was very wealthy, had 5 or 6 figures in Wall Street, how would an improved relationship with Europe affect my holdings in Wall Street? And, of course, if I'm at the other end of the socioeconomic spectrum, I get a check every month, how would that, an improved relationship with Europe, affect me?
Chuck, thanks for the call. I think we got the point. Let me put it to Dennis Bark, because we heard Richard Morningstar speak just a moment ago about the importance of trade between the two. Dennis, how would you answer Chuck's question?
Well, I think I would go at it sideways and not answer it directly. I mean, the easy way to answer it is if there's less conflict in the world and we're doing it together with the Europeans, it's going to cost the American taxpayers less and it's going to leave more money in their pocket. That's the answer to a simple question. Where I think it is important and makes an enormous difference for Europeans and Americans to focus on something together is in Israel and Palestine, and we are doing that. That is where the Europeans, in many ways, expected us to go following removing the Taliban in Afghanistan. And having said that, I think it's equally important to remind Americans who unfortunately don't see it in their news daily newspapers that the Europeans are still with us in Afghanistan. The commander of the troops in Afghanistan at the moment is a European. They've been there from the beginning. Americans have not read that fighter sorties were flown by both the French and the Dutch, along with American aircraft in Afghanistan. It made the job there much easier and the outcome much more effective. I don't mean to be cute in my answer to your question about Wall Street or the other end of the economic spectrum, but that's a complicated question, and to give you the simple answer, I think, is I'll stick with the one I gave you beforehand.
All right. Quickly, we have a comment from Stephen in Nashua, New Hampshire. Emphasis on quickly, Stephen. Thanks. Go ahead.
Yes, I was just saying I've talked with my colleagues and relatives in Europe. They like America. They like Americans. They can't understand the Bush administration. I think they're just trying to wait this out. They like, for example, they told me they like their visit of Condi Rice. They like her style, but style and substance are two different things. They do not understand the Bush administration's policies, but they like Americans, so they kind of have mixed feelings about us.
All right. Thanks, Stephen, for the call. And an interesting point, Richard Morningstar. You know, style does count, doesn't it?
Well, style certainly counts. And, you know, we've had issues with Europe going back for years and years and years. But it has been, I think, worse over the past 4 years, and in good part because of style and also some of the changes in the relationship that Charles Kupchan talked about since the end of the Cold War. But I can say from my time in Brussels, President Clinton was in office, we had plenty of issues with Europe, but yet we didn't have the same kind of bitterness, and I think a lot of that was because of how Europeans perceived President Clinton as compared to how they perceived President Bush. But I hope that as a result of this visit and because of the seeming recognition on the part of President Bush and Secretary of State Rice that the European relationship is critically important, that Europeans will begin to see another side of President Bush.
Richard Morningstar, we'll have to leave it there for now. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Former ambassador to the European Union, Dennis Bark, thanks so much for joining us as well.
Thank you so much.
Author of the forthcoming book, Dancing in the Dark, Conversations on Europe and America. And you can continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on Forums. I'm Gail Harris. This is On Point. When On Point contributor Sue Diaz's son, Roman, returned home last fall after a year and a half in Iraq, she was hopeful that his remaining 2 years in the Army would be served in a non-combat zone. Then came his reassignment last month to the 101st Airborne Division, a unit likely to be heading back to Iraq later this year. Sue Diaz recently saw her son during a short leave as he traveled from a base in Germany to one in Kentucky. In this radio diary, she reflects on Roman's visit home and what she sees in the photos he brought home from Iraq.
I peeked into the sunny bedroom at the end of the hall, and for a moment it seemed as if the past 2 years had never happened, as if my son, Roman, had never left home at 18 to join the Army, as if he'd never been deployed for 15 long months in Iraq. Because when I glanced over at the desk in the corner, there he was again, in blue jeans and a T-shirt, hunched in front of his computer, a bottle of Dr. Pepper near his right hand, yesterday's socks scattered on the floor. But in place of his old high school backpack, a weathered green duffel bag now leaned against the wall. In the baggage claim area at the airport earlier in the week, I tried to lift that bag and couldn't budge it. Roman quickly stepped over and scooped it up with one hand. "Hey, Mom," Roman said, catching a glimpse of me at the bedroom door. "Come here. Check this out." He wanted to show me the small computer he had bought, packed, and sent here from Germany. That's where the 1st Armored, the division he'd served with in Iraq, is based, and where he'd lived the past 6 months. The new orders he'd received in Baumholder a few weeks earlier were sending him now to the 101st Airborne in Fort Campbell, Kentucky. That would be his next stop, as soon as the 10-day leave he was on was over. Roman's infantry unit with the 1st Armored had the distinction of serving the longest deployment of any division in Iraq. And now, according to a recent Pentagon announcement, soldiers from the 101st Airborne, where he's headed, will make up a significant part of U.S. forces in Iraq and Afghanistan starting in 2005. We didn't talk much about the likelihood of his return to the war. Instead, we chatted that day about his computer, its speed, its size, its amazing graphics. And what are those, I asked, pointing to two on-screen icons labeled Iraq 1 and Iraq 2. Pictures I took with my digital camera when I was over there, he said. Can I see them? With a couple of mouse clicks, the digital slideshow he created began, and its images are seared in my memory. Hovering helicopters in silhouette against a blood-red sky. Acres of confiscated mortar shells, AK-47s, rifles. Humvees with no doors. Buildings with no walls. The head of a child's doll lying in the dust, its plastic face blistered, its tiny ears singed. The back seat of an empty car, mottled with stains the color of terracotta tile. A spider hole, half hidden by brambles. The hole Saddam didn't crawl out of, my son said with a wry grin. The only other times he smiled were at pictures of his buddies in Bravo Company. Before each of those photos faded into the next, he'd hurry to name every one of his comrades, even though for most distances, with their army haircuts and their desert khakis, they all looked alike to me. That's Ramirez, Stanfell, Davis, Sergeant Hurd, he said, touching the screen with the tip of his finger, as if I would remember all their names, as if he could ever forget. Off in the distance in one of those group shots, I couldn't help but notice black smoke coiling into an impossibly blue sky. Were there any places over there that you'd walk through the streets and say, nice neighborhood, you know, like here, I asked. No, not really, he said, shaking his head. Not anymore. Just then a tight close-up of a big, bright yellow sunflower filled the screen and just as quickly disappeared. Wait, go back, I said. And when he did, I added, where'd that come from? The flower? I took that picture one morning after the warehouse we'd been holed up in had taken a lot of enemy fire. It seemed so weird to come out and see something so pretty, still standing in the middle of, well, in the middle of all that. And on the screen, more snapshots from that dusty corner of hell continued. Now he's gone again. Roman left a few days later on another plane heading east. But the improbable beauty of that sunflower has stayed with me. It's with me still. Through whatever lies ahead for this soldier of ours, now with the 101st Airborne, I will hold on to the stubborn hope embodied by that bloom. Embodied, too, by the young man who, after one particularly long night at his post in Iraq, put down his gun to point a camera at its petals.
Sue Diaz is a regular contributor to On Point. This essay first appeared in Newsweek. Sue lives in San Diego, California. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.